Welcome, everybody. It's 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the last day of Tech Ed. You've all made it to this final day. Well done. And you all seem to be awake at remarkably early in the morning. So give yourselves a round of applause. You've all been really awesome. Now, I do feel like 9 o'clock spots are kind of the booby's prize for everybody. You know, it's kind of hard to get you all awake and thinking and listening. So I want you all just to quickly stand up for me. I'm not going to make you do anything too awkward. Just stand up, get the blood flowing, get your brain in gear. And I'm just going to say hello to you guys, and I want you to say hello back, and I want to be able to hear it. So, hello, everybody.
Hello.
Oh, that wasn't very loud. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Okay, you sound awake. Thank you very much, everybody. Okay, so welcome to my talk. So I'm Owen, and I'm going to tell you how to grow me. So I'm going to tell you how to plant me in water, in soil, and give me some water, and I'll grow. Awesome. I've dubiously titled this talk, How to Grow, and of course, I don't really know anything about your companies or where you come from or your organizations. So maybe that's kind of the incorrect title. Maybe I should say how to maybe grow. Because what I'm hoping to do here is share with you a few little war stories, a few little things that I keep in the back of my mind when I run an engineering team. All things that I learned while I was at Xero for a number of years as chief architect. And now I'm starting my own startup and running my own team and learning that as I go along. So first, a big disclaimer. So in no way am I an expert. I was chief architect at Xero for a couple of years at the end of my Xero career, and before that I was a senior developer. So I'm not even really a trained manager. I don't really like doing managerial stuff. I don't like doing performance reviews or paperwork or anything kind of you associate with a HR style of manager. Instead, I really like working out how to enable teams and enable people in teams to do amazing work and to get the best out of themselves, and enabling a culture and a team dynamic that allows people to produce their best work. So I'm afraid this talk won't give you any answers. It won't give you any golden bullets. So I'll give you a couple of seconds now. If that was what you were coming to a talk to do, you're more than welcome to leave and go to another talk. Because I won't give you any of those final answers. Instead, what I'll share with you is, as I say, some of those things that I learned. So this is a stage of Xero that I joined. In the middle there is our first ever Tech Ed outing as Xero. And I joined a month after that, so I actually never had one of those tic-tac-toe t-shirts. They were like hen's teeth, they were golden. But kind of on the left, you can see me right at the very back. And that's essentially the whole engineering team at that point crowded around our CTO's computer going ooh and ah because he's just got a brand new Mac Pro. You know, it's the important things in life that work. And at that stage, this is what a product meeting would look like. You know, four of us around a computer saying, should we put a button here? Oh, I don't know. What do you think? Oh, maybe. Maybe not. So that was the stage that I joined Xero. By the time I left, it looked a little bit more like this. So when I left, there were 500 people in the whole organization. Xero's technical team had grown significantly. So this is a picture from this year, actually. So I'm not part of Xero at this point, but it's of a very similar stage. This is their developer day, where they get developers and operations teams together to talk about the state of the Xero nation. And this is an initiative that got started pretty much 2 days before I left. So if there's one legacy that I'd like to leave Xero with, I'm hoping it's this. It's that time when they get together and they talk to each other. Nowadays, however, I'm working with a team like this. So this is the Hoist team, and actually we've got a whole bunch of extras in this photo. So the Hoist team is actually only three of those people, or four of those people. So I'm really back down to grassroots, back down to a very, very small team. And I'm picking up on all the things that I did when I was at Xero, and kind of looking back and retrospectively working out what I did right and what I did wrong and what we did right and what we did wrong. So hopefully I can share some of those things with you today. Do you feel like coming on a journey? So if you're successful as a software team, and no matter what happens, if you're successful, well, then growth just kind of happens. You close your eyes one day and you wake up and you've suddenly got a team when you just had a bunch of friends before. Now you've got to kind of do managerial processes or work out how things can communicate across more than one desk or three desks or five desks or two offices or three countries. And if you're not really thinking about it at the beginning or as early as possible, then things can start to stray at the edges. They can fray. They can get lost. And you start to lose some of that culture, that dynamic that made your team a wonderful place to work. So now I'm back at the beginning. I'm revisiting that history, and I'm working out what we did and what went right. So let's see if we can share some of those things. So if there's one thing that you take away from this talk today, and there's only one thing, then just remember this. The most important thing in an engineering team is trust. Everything else that I'll talk about later on comes back to this idea of building trust within your developers, allowing them to trust you, allowing you to trust them, allowing them as a team to do their best work. Because at the beginning, there's just kind of one of you, or at least in my case, there's just one of us. And you start doing some of your best work. You're free. You're enabled. You trust yourself to get that release out the door. You want to fix that bug. You want to really, really see the look on your user's face when you get that software out the door. You trust yourself to do the most amazing work possible, and it's incredibly freeing to be given that trust. So why is it that as we grow, we expect people's motivations to change? Why is it that, as someone said to me the other day, when they left the team to go and join another team, he said, "It's amazing, Owen. They treat me like adults, and we get shit done." So why is that not the norm? Why do we not just treat people with the trust that they need to get the job done, to achieve the goals that they came to work to do, that they picked up a career to do? Why do we not enable these things? So a lot of what I'm going to talk about, really, is just building trust and enabling trusted positions within your engineering teams, and a way to enable people to work together in a trusted way. So let's start at the end. It's the most important part of a software release process, isn't it? Kind of the only time you know when you've done an engineering job properly is after it goes live. There is no previous point where you know whether it's actually worked the way you think it's worked, whether you actually know the users are using it in the way you expected them to use it. You can go through any stages of QA, design, development, and the final release is the only time when things are proven to work, or in most cases, not work. As a famous saying goes, no plan survives contact with the enemy unchanged. It's exactly the same with software development. No release goes exactly the way you expect it to be. So step one towards trusting your team and enabling your developers to feel that trust is that releasing software should be boring. It should be the most mundane thing you do as a software development team. If you can't release tomorrow or the day after, then you're doing it wrong. You should be automating all the things from now, from right now. Everything that gets your software into development needs to be automated right now, if it's not already. Hopefully most of you already automated. At the beginning at Xero, our release process was essentially our CTO building the software on his computer underneath his desk and then x-copying those files up to live. It's the most awful process. It just can't scale. It just can't work as you grow a team. You enable one person to become the bottleneck for releases. You end up building a whole bunch of rigor and fanfare around releases. And in the end of the day, back in 2007, it actually wasn't that easy to get good automated releases going live very, very quickly. Essentially, to build a build server, you had to go and install Visual Studio, a full license copy onto a build server just to get it to build C#. So I don't blame the fact, you know, I don't say that that was a mistake of the time. It's just the case that 2007, it wasn't done. Nowadays, we have a lot of tools to help us out. We have things like Octopus Deploy or Capistrano or a whole bunch of tooling that's there to make it deadly simple for you to get your software live and in the hands of your users as soon as possible. Because as we scaled at zero, our release process became a huge, huge bottleneck. So Craig Walker, our CDO, had to be on hand for every single release. He had to either be in late at night or early in the morning. It also meant that releases had that fanfare. They were respected. They were things you didn't do too often, and you made them as short as possible in your own mind, so that if something went wrong or a bug was found, patching those bugs was another long process. You're not just rolling forward very, very quickly. And you end up having to add a whole bunch of complexity to your process just for the final hurrah. And then releases ended up happening irregularly and not very quickly. So software developers would end up having there was a huge cost to this release process. It was taking a lot of time and a lot of manpower. Things were going wrong, and then you wouldn't repeat it for another 3 months or whatever you take because, hey, we've got to fear the release, so let's put as much as possible into this release. And you end up with a real lack of motivation for the engineering team. So any engineer on that team, having worked on something 3 months ago, has now put that code down, moved on to something else, has forgotten the fact that they wrote that code ever, and now suddenly it's gone live and they're getting bugs for that code because, as I said before, nothing goes live without some edge case that you've not thought of to your users. So you need to get that code to live as soon as possible while it's still in the heads of your developers so that they can fix it, so that they can feel like they're actually achieving something as an engineering team. Otherwise, you're just spinning your wheels as an engineering team and nobody's feeling like they're achieving anything as a company. You might have good hurrahs internally and saying, yep, we built that feature, but nobody's seen it. So nobody actually gets any encouragement to do more of that work. So you can't work like that. It's not fair on anybody. Not your users, not your engineering team, not your QAs, not your product developers, not your designers. So you need to invest upfront in automation. So hopefully you all are, and that's just preaching to the converted. But just in case there's anybody out here who doesn't have an automated release process that relies on somebody manually clicking a button, stop it. Go and spend some time, some energy, and automate that process as much as you can. Because as you're growing, you're going to want to do stuff that isn't just located in one place. You're going to want to do stuff that isn't just located on one or three servers. You're going to end up with tens of hundreds of servers that you have to deploy to, from web servers to infrastructure servers to database servers. So automate all the things. From that learning at zero at Hoist, now we have a continuous deployment process so that anytime somebody checks in to our master branch, it goes live. Because we know that by the time it's hit master, we would have been through test. And there is no rigmarole around releasing. It's all automated. Nobody presses any buttons anywhere. It just sets off scripts, and our code gets deployed. So speaking about master branches, I guess from the end to the beginning. Sorry, I've got a really dry throat. So at the beginning, what's the one thing, what's the one tool that all engineering teams need? Source control. Okay. So at the beginning of Zero, when I joined, we were on Visual Source Safe, actually. I kid you not. For a week while I was there, we were on Visual Source Safe. And that week was me spent migrating Visual Source Safe to TFS originally, and then to Subversion. So for a vast majority of the time while I was at Zero, the Zero source code was in Subversion. There's nothing secret about anything I'm going to tell you. I'm sure other people would back me up and tell you any of these things. They're all things that we've done. They're not going to affect the stock price, and I don't know any user numbers, so don't come and ask me. So we were on Subversion for a number of years, and then one thing happened. So one thing that pushed us beyond Subversion, and that was that Craig, our CDO, moved to New York. So our CTO, one of the core engineering team members, moves to another time zone, another country, and across a big pond. So of course, we have Subversion. Subversion is a central source control. It has one source of truth, and that was running on a server, because we're all a New Zealand-based company, so where's our server? Of course, it's based in Wellington, because, you know, where else would you put a central source control server? Which becomes a real pain if you distribute your team at all, anywhere. Suddenly you've got this one place where your entire engineering team has to get contact to just to commit changes to source control. So I remember back in 2008, late 2007 or 2008, I saw a video that went round. And this video was a guy called Linus, and he was talking about his brand new source control system called Git. And he was preaching the idea that Linux developers, so I presume everybody knows who Linus is. Anybody not know? I should check that before I go any further. Okay. So Linus is a guy who built Linux, essentially. So he built an open source operating system. And Linux is built by many, many developers all around the world. And previously, they've been using a centralized source control system, and he come up with the idea of Git. So Git is decentralized source control. Anybody not know what I mean by that? Okay, that's generally quite good. Okay, a couple of people. So I'll just I'll really quickly explain what a decentralized source control system is. So most source control systems happen, your engineers will make a change to some source code, and then they'll check it into a central server somewhere. And they'll say, this is my change, here server, have my change. And then that central server has a list of all the changes. Any other engineers want to come along and grab all the changes, they go to that central server and go, give me the changes. Very, very simple. Decentralized source control system tends to work in one way, in that every user and every developer has their own version of the source control system. So they have their own history, their own way of managing check-ins and check-outs on their local machine. So Git or Mercurial work very similar ways, in that you have the whole history of your source on your machine. And then you check in and you check out to your local machine. It's very, very quick and very, very fast. And then when you want to share that change, you push it to somewhere else. So you push it up to a server somewhere, or you push it to another user, or they can pull it from you. Okay? And so, amazingly, Git works really, really well as you start to distribute your team, because everybody needs to work in a very, very fast way. Everybody needs to make their changes and understand the history of how the source has become the source control that they've currently got. And they can do that in a very, very quick way if they're working on a decentralized source control system. So as you start to grow your team, you start to see all of these barriers to growing, and you start to knock them down one by one by one. So one of them is this idea that you have to have your source control in one central system. Instead, you can allow engineers the trust to manage their own source control, their own changes, their own check-ins, and then push those changes to a central place once they want it to build, for example, or to get the final verification of what they've done works. So at Xero, within the last 2 years I was there, we'd moved to a Git model. So we were using GitHub Enterprise, and all of our source control was managed that way, rather than working on a central source control. Now, we did have a central place where the build would check, so our build machines would look for changes. So you kind of, you either need a way of pushing changes to your build machine, or you need a central place that your build machine can watch. But it doesn't mean that it needs to slow down your developers and your engineers on a day-to-day basis. You need to trust them with that work. Sorry. Probably one of the core things when you're building an engineering team is hiring. Anybody here do hiring for their teams? Okay, a number of you. So I'm not going to espouse the Joel Spolsky smart and gets things done idea. That's done. Everybody kind of understands that. You know, you want people who are go-getters, who can go out there and actually do work. You want good developers. That seems like saying, you know, the obvious. Instead, I like to have this idea of you want to hire for the jobs you have right now. So it can be really tempting when you know you're growing an engineering team and you know you're growing a product of scale to hire for the scale that you're going to have in a year or 2 years or 3 years' time and say, wow, you've worked on a really, really awesome big system. Come and work for me right now. We're working on a very, very small system, but you know, one day we'll get there and we'll need your help. That can kind of really destroy your engineering team. and give you the wrong skills at the wrong time. I recently read a book. It's not on engineering per se. It's by Ben Horowitz. It's The Hard Thing About Hard Things. And if you're even slightly interested in how businesses build themselves, I'd suggest going and reading that. And he's talking about hiring an executive team, but I'm finding the same kind of guidance works very, very well when you're hiring an engineering team. And he says that as your company grows and as your engineering team grows, you're actually becoming lots of different companies. It's no longer the same company when you're 20 people to 100 people. Those are two different companies needing two different skill sets. When you're a small company, you often need people who are really proactive, who are generalists, who can go out and find the work that needs to be done because there's so much work and not much management that you need people who are proactively finding the right problems to solve. So people who've worked in that small environment are very, very good in that small environment. As you get bigger and as you start to grow your team, it starts to work in a much, much different, quite a different way. You end up needing people who can delegate work, who can give work to other people because otherwise they'll get swamped. You need people who can become masters of their domain and understand where the edges are going to happen and where their problem domain exists. So you need to hire for the jobs you've got, not the jobs you're going to have in 2 years. Of course, keep them on your books because you're going to need them in 2 years' time, but don't bring them in too early because you will end up with people who are sitting around not doing the work that you really need them to do and destroying a culture a little bit at the beginning. And then the opposite side of this is as you grow, you end up with a lot of those generalists who are now proactively going out and finding work. They end up being very easy to burn out. So those early team members are the ones you really need to watch. They're the ones who are so proactive, and they're the ones who are known to get stuff done, so they get all the work sent to them. So you need to manage this. Burnout is a real, real difficulty and a real thing, and I don't have any solutions for this apart from to watch out for it happening. And it's usually the early engineering team that gets burnout as the team grows, because they end up being the funnel for all this work. And then they're not very good at delegating because they've never learned those skills, because they've never been in such a big organization. So they end up doing all the work themselves, and they're burning the candle at both ends. Now, as you grow your engineering team, there's going to be one thing that you're going to have to do. It's the nature of the beast. You're going to have specialists. So as I said at the beginning, you're going to hire generalists at the beginning and then specialists later on. But more than that, your engineering team itself is going to specialize. You're going to have certain engineers and QAs and designers who sit together, work on the same product day in, day out, and they're specialists of that domain. And you kind of want to encourage this. It's not a bad thing as such. As a developer, a lot of your work is about remembering. It's about remembering what CoPass led you to where you are. It's about keeping a lot of variables in mind. It's about keeping a lot of use cases in mind as you're developing this code. So the more you understand your problem domain and the software you're working on, the better engineer you are. However, it can be really daunting to say that somebody's going to be working on the same system for 5 years. It's just not interesting to a developer. They want to be able to move around. So at Xero, they had the concept of pods. So pods are basically different aspects of their software suite. So they might have a pod that's specialized in reporting, or a pod that's specialized in the core accounting product, or a pod that's specialized in Xero Personal. And that's not just developers, that's QAs, and that's designers that are all specialized all together. And they're not too far away from each other. I like to say when I was at Xero that they had to be within 3 desks of getting a question answered about their specialization. So if you needed some answer immediately, and as developers, you always need answers immediately because you're right in that problem space, you need it quite quickly, you shouldn't have to go too far to find that answer. However, if you're working in your specialization and need an answer from somewhere else, from some other system, you should be okay to wait for that. You should be okay to think of that as an asynchronous nature. So you can go much further than 3 desks to find an answer from a different system. The one thing I would say about specialization is make sure that you encourage your engineers to switch. so that they do not stay in the specialization for more than 12 months. You want them there for about 6 months, but you don't really want them there for more than a year. You want them to learn and spread that knowledge around the organization. I'm not sure we did that enough at Xero. It's definitely something that I want to encourage more as I go further. Your domain knowledge, as you build up a specialist system, you learn lots of new techniques and lots of new challenges, and you want that to spread around your organization and spread around your engineering team. So you need engineers to work in different teams, in different specializations as they go along. Obviously, you don't need an entire team to come off one specialization and go into another one, because suddenly you've got no specialists over here to pick up any slack. You kind of want a rotating policy. And that works generally really well. So let's face facts here in New Zealand. There's just never enough developers. And there's never enough developers anywhere. But realistically, here in New Zealand, we're a very, very small market. So if you're building an engineering team and you want it to be a growing engineering team, you need to understand one thing. You are going to be hiring remote staff at some point. And I don't necessarily mean people who are working from home or their local internet cafe. I do mean that people who aren't necessarily in the same office as you. So you might have another office. You know? At Xero, we had Wellington, Auckland, Canberra, San Francisco, New York, London. There's lots of different offices around the place. And they all have a certain level of engineering skill in them. They all need to be able to pick up on work. They all need to be able to do their work. And the way that we split out engineering talent around the regions was generally following that pod model. So specializations would be based in a certain office. Now, if you wanted to talk to another specialization, another pod, you might be going to a different office, another time zone. But one of the core things about remote is that it's not just kind of, hey, one day I work from home, I will understand remote now. You need your entire engineering team to understand what it's like to be on the end of a VC meeting, a video conference meeting, not a venture capitalist meeting. I should specify. And you need to understand what it's like to have to find information without being able to go to the desk next door. It's a really difficult skill to get. It's a really difficult skill to understand that when you're putting on a meeting in the office, that there might be people who are interested in this meeting who aren't here. I need to record this meeting. I need to write down this meeting. I need to make sure it's recorded somewhere. I need to circulate the notes. I need to make sure that all the other engineering teams around the world know what we've spoken about because it's important to them. And even if it's not necessarily important to them, if it suddenly amazingly becomes important to them, they need to know where to look to go and find these things. So I encourage you all to go and understand what working remote feels like. So as the first step, you need to get yourself out of your office. You need to go and work from a cafe for a few days a week, for a period of time, and understand how your interactions with your engineering team are going. I work from home for a couple of days a week just to ensure that that happens. I make sure that my other engineer, who is also in Wellington in the same office, also works from home for a couple of days a week, just so that we make sure that any edges around how we work for a remote team are picked up very, very early. Because I know as I build up an engineering team for Hoist, they're going to be dotted absolutely everywhere and anywhere. And I want to find the talent wherever it is. So if you want to build a growing team, you need to understand remote. And it is really hard talent to just understand very, very quickly. You need to experience it. And most of it comes down to communication. I'm probably kind of telling you things you already know, you know. Communication is paramount when you're working remotely and a growing team across continents, across time zones. When we started at Xero, and probably until I left, this was very much an unsolved problem for us. There was far too much reliance on emails or people just getting up and going to talk to people. So that's great when you're a small team. I absolutely love it, and I espouse it, and I love people getting up and going to ask questions. But what happens is as you grow, nobody knows who to go and ask those questions. And then they go and ask somebody, well, who should I ask this question of? And they go, oh, Bob. Great, who's Bob? You know, the hardest thing as you grow an engineering team is that suddenly there are people you don't know. There are people who walk in and you go, well, do you work for me? I'm not quite sure. you know, you could be one of our engineers from all around the world. I don't know who you are. Have I met before? I apologize. I've got 200 people in my staff. I don't know what's going on. Help me. So you need good communication lines. You need, nowadays there's great, great tools. So there's Slack, there's HipChat, there's IRC. IRC's been around forever, but there's Yammer. I've got to say Yammer, I'm at a Microsoft conference. There are great, great tools for communication, for inter-office communication. And as engineers, they are bound to have opinions over what tool they want to use. One thing you can guarantee for engineers is they'll have opinions about tools. What I would say is support their decisions, understand why they're deciding one tool over another, and let them run with it for a little while. Actually, let them run with those tools. The worst thing you can do is decide that you're using these two tools for exactly the same conversations. Half of you have one open, half of you have the other open. Let's just decide on which one we're going to use. But that's fine. You can have a little bit of time running with both of them so that everybody can understand what the two tools are. That's, you know, there's a religious debate between Slack or HipChat right now. I have no opinion either way, but I like my team to understand both tools so that they can understand which one they want. But enable communication. So enable real quick-time communication, asynchronous communication. Allow people to leave messages and then get messages later. Allow people to have very quick debates around topics or any topic they want, you know. One of the greatest tools that we have at Hoist is a room just called Water Cooler. It's just a very simple room where anybody can put whatever they want in. I don't really care. It helps with so many different things. Suddenly somebody's having an idea on the water cooler because somebody else has mentioned something in a TV show they saw or some random video that they saw online, and then they take that chat into some other room and they go off and kind of build up a big product decision from it. So have free-form discussion. As you grow a distributed team, it's very important that those can happen online as well as offline. So usually as we've built a small team, we've all been in the office, so you have those discussions by serendipity. You have those office in the cafeteria, or you have those discussions in the cafe, or, you know, with your local barista, or over the water cooler, of course. So enable those things to happen online as well as offline. And then there's the documentation. And I don't mean your user guide that you give to your end users of your software. I don't really care about technical documentation in that level. It's not that interesting to me. I actually also don't really care for code standards or, you know, those kind of documents that you hand around your engineering team and say, these are the rules, you must follow them, because these are the rules, and you must follow them. And we decided 5 years ago that these are the rules, and we haven't changed them since, and nobody's read them since, but we still follow them somehow. Instead, code standards tend to come out of the code that you've already written, in my belief. So you should pick up on the things that you've already done and change them if they're bad and make sure that you don't let any kind of broken windows through and fix them up. But what I really mean here is a documentation that lets your staff understand who to go and ask questions of, where to find the answers, what things are done and why they're done and why you made certain decisions. And there's one thing that will guide you through how to write documentation, and that's the concept of the question. So all good documentation for staff comes from the idea that there is a question at heart. I've never met somebody going searching through a documentation without a question that they're trying to answer. Generally happens that way. Hey, who do I ask for free lunch around here? Who do I ask when I want to go and modify this bit of code? Oh, who's in charge of this server? Oh, how do I log on to these servers? There's always questions. So you need to support the question style of documentation finding. At Xero, some of our early junior engineers came on, and they picked up on this better than I did. And they went, we don't have a system for this. We really want Stack Overflow internally, or something like that. It would be really good and really great. And they built a tool. They built a tool called Xero Answers. And I can't actually tell you if it's still in use there. I hope it is. No, not particularly. But I still think that concept of having a question and answers forum is the best way to get documentation to your engineers, to your users, to your internal staff. Confluence have an answers product specifically for this. You go in and you type in a question or you search for a question and you can get an answer. And that answer doesn't have to be the answer. It can point to other documentation elsewhere. But the key is that the gateway into your documentation is always going to be the question. It's never going to be anything else. You're always going to have somebody searching for the answer to a question. And if they don't find the answer to the question, it's a sign that they need to write the answer to the question. So you need to make sure that everybody who comes on board understands that if they ever look for documentation and they've asked a question and it's not come up with an answer, they need to go and find the answer, obviously. But once they found the answer, they need to then write that question and that answer into whatever system you're using. But it's a very core kind of concept to how we write documentation internally now at Hoist. So time. I've never, I can't really stress this enough, ever seen an engineering team that has enough time. Pretty obvious. We all have more work than we know what to do with. We all have more things that we need to get done. We all don't have enough hours in the day to get the work done that we've been told by head office or up above or our users need to be done. But that's not going to change. That's never going to change. We're not going to challenge it by hiring 20, 30 more developers. It's just going to be a bigger list. Instead, what I like to think of is that time spent on the product is great. But engineering is a learned skill. It's a practiced skill. It's something that you need to give your engineers time to practice, to learn, to pick up more skills, to understand their problem domain, to pick up on new technologies, to actually understand why the hell they're doing what they're doing, to understand and remember why they came into software development in the first place. At Xero, we had a very failed experiment. I'm going to say it's failed because it never really took off, in that we really wanted to give our engineers time. We really wanted to give them an impetus to go and find those new skills. So we would give them Friday projects. We'd let them go away and work on their own projects on Fridays. In hindsight, probably one of the worst decisions we ever made. Not because we gave them time, that was a very good thing to do, but we didn't force them to do it. We said, hey, you go away and find a project and you can do it, that's fine, we'll support you, that's all right. Nobody put down their work to go and learn these things. Everybody said, hey, you don't give me enough time to do my own thing. Well, I told you, you can go work on Fridays, but I was busy with my other thing. I said, but it doesn't matter, you put that down and you go. No, nobody understood. So I'm a big admirer of the Trade Me FedEx days. I think they do really pretty stuff, so well done. So the FedEx day is a day where they come together and actually hack on code and actually don't do other work. They do interesting projects for a whole day. It's a good period of time. You lock it off and you say, nah, this is what you're working on for today. And you can go away and use any skills you want and you can learn lots of new stuff. But you have to give engineers an ultimatum, essentially. They're not very good at putting down the work that they're currently doing. I've never met an engineer who doesn't like just get deeply involved in the work they're doing. So afternoons on a Friday is probably not the best thing to say to an engineer, oh, you can use that to go and do your own thing. It just doesn't work. You need a whole day to allow engineers their own time. You need a reason to do it. So you need to all come together and have fun, you know, get them pizzas, actually get them in the room, give them a challenge or something like that. But go ahead and give them the time to pick up their own skills. Because it's important as an engineer, as a motivator, as building up a good team, you want to give them time to learn these skills. So, in my mind, this is the one thing that's killing our industry slowly, and that's the lack of diversity. I mean, we've heard an awful lot about it, especially this year and last year. I don't mean hiring robots. We like robots at Hoist, but we actually don't have any that work for us apart from on T-shirts and stuff. But diversity itself, and if you don't think diversity is a problem, if you actually just want to switch off when I say diversity is a problem, then you're part of the problem, I'm afraid. You need to go away and have a really, really deep look at your organization, at how you're making it hard to enter your organization, how you're making it hard to be part of your organization. I'm not about to say that at Xero I was proud of the level of diversity we achieved, because I'm not going to be proud until we were 50-50. But we were something like 20% female engineers, I'd say. Probably that's maybe a little bit generous, but somewhere around about there was 20%. And the one key to building a good diverse team was a chicken and egg problem. You have to have female engineers to attract other female engineers. It's just something that happens. And how do you attract that first female engineer? How do you actually make sure that they'll stay on the team and actually apply for the jobs, for one thing, because they are out there. They're some of the best engineers I've met and have worked with. So they exist. They're not unique flowers. They're actually there working, doing some of the best work in our industry. So we should support them and find out why they're not joining your organization if they're not already. And one of the ways that you can really help diversify your team is to be willing to hire juniors. So anybody been on an engineering jobs board recently and looked at the jobs that are available? At least 90% of those say senior or 5 to 10 years experience required, or something like that. I think that's a real failing of our industry, that we're only going out there with jobs for senior people, and we think that's the only way we can hire good engineers, is to say, you have to have worked in the industry for 5 years to be a good engineer, so we'll only hire people who've worked in the industry for 5 years. We end up with this non-repeater, you know, we're not replenishing the stock of engineers, we're not actually training anybody up. And believe you me, when I worked for an organization in Wellington called Summer of Tech, and we help farm students to companies for internships over the summer. It's a great little way to kind of get a taste of what a student's like and then hire them at the end of the summer. There's other programs, Microsoft Student Accelerator is one up here. But it's not actually that hard to go out there and find juniors, find students, find graduates to actually bring on board. What's really hard to do is to work out how to mentor them, how to train them up. You need to give your engineers the ability to actually take time to train up junior staff. And you might say, hey, we don't have enough time to take on junior engineers. We need to have people who hit the ground running, who can do all this work amazingly, immediately. I'd argue that what you really want to do is farm half of the work that your senior engineers are currently doing to junior engineers, because they know what they're doing. The senior engineers already know that work. They can teach somebody else that work. Think of it like an apprenticeship. You need to take that work that's being done by the senior engineer and give that work to a junior engineer, and then the role that you were going to hire a senior engineer for, give it back to your senior engineer. So they're actually doing the senior work, they're building up their senior portfolio, and then they're farming out the work that they used to do to a junior level, which is then coming up and becoming the next level of seniors. You'll also find that a diverse group of engineers is much, much easier to find in a junior or graduate role. They haven't been pushed out by the industry. They haven't found all of those rough edges yet, all of the reasons why they no longer want to be an engineer. There's a huge, huge statistic of how many females drop out of our industry after only a couple of years because it's very, very difficult to get ahead when you're an engineer and a female. Instead, be supportive and hire juniors, train them up. And you will find a lot of female junior engineers straight out of university, and they're some of the best engineers that you can possibly want to meet. I know that because I've hired one. Hoist engineer number 2 is female because she was the most amazing engineer straight out of university. And I'm happy to say that. And some of the best engineers we got at Xero came out of Summer of Tech or out of student programs, and they were great team members to bring up. Because one thing, they don't know any better, so they're going to espouse and cheer for your company no matter what. As long as you treat them like an adult and a human being and give them a good paycheck, they're going to go, this is the best place to work ever. I've never worked anywhere else, but it's the best place to work ever. Yay. So they'll actually encourage other people to come and join your organization. They'll encourage their friends, and you'll get and by having a nice, diverse team, you'll have a nice, diverse team. It's kind of like this self-perpetuating cycle. It's really strange. But no matter where I've been in the world, and I've spoken to a number of different engineering teams around the world, they all say exactly the same thing. I say, well, how did you get a lot of females on your engineering team? Well, I had a lot of females on my engineering team. It just kind of happened. I had one, and then I had 2, and then I had 3. It's just amazing. But it's kind of that getting that first one that's kind of core. And I don't mean like just your token female. I mean, go and hire a good engineer, but be open to hiring juniors and people who are outside of your usual pool. You need to go beyond the usual, you know, comp sci graduate who's been in the industry for 5 years. So look outside your normal networks. This one's dear to my heart. It's this concept that, so I went to Silicon Valley a couple of months ago, And, you know, I went to GitHub and Heroku and a whole bunch of other engineering teams. And it's horrible. Like, it's great, don't get me wrong. Like, GitHub have a bigger bar than any other San Francisco bar. Like, just their ground floor is an entire bar, and it's a warehouse. So it's a big, big space. And, you know, I've previously been out on a couple of nights out with people, and you're crammed into a tiny little San Fran bar, and you go to GitHub, and they've got a full bar in this warehouse. And, and to get to that bar, you have to go in through a replica of the Oval Office. Incredibly gimmicky. It's like our CEO said, man, this is like Disneyland for developers. And it is kind of like that. And then I went to Heroku, and they had cold press coffee on tap. I don't know if anybody knows how expensive cold press coffee is, but if you're paying for Heroku right now, that's probably where all of your fees are going. And then I went to LinkedIn, and you had a full lunch for 1,000 people put on for free all the time. Now, these things are what I like to call gimmicks. I mean, I'm pretty sure you'd all agree with me. They're all just gimmicks. The trouble with San Fran and the Bay Area is that because everybody does it, everybody now has to do it. So it's no longer a differentiator that you serve breakfast. And I don't mean breakfast. I mean 55 different types of cereal, just in case one person joins who doesn't like the 53 other ones. That engineers no longer care. They have to have those gimmicks to actually join an engineering team because they have to have those gimmicks to join an engineering team. I've never met an engineer who says, who I've asked, well, why do you work for GitHub? Oh, they gave me free lunch. Yeah, that was why I joined. It's just I couldn't find free lunch anywhere else, so I joined GitHub. I've never met a TradeMe engineer, sorry for TradeMe, who I asked, why do you work for TradeMe? Well, it was their free slide. Really like their slide. Or a Xero engineer who I met who said, why did you join Xero? Well, we had a free barista, and that was the reason why I joined. I quite like New Zealand in that we haven't fallen down this gimmick trap. We haven't actually started doing this too much. We don't put too much weight on baristas or slides. We put weight on a challenging problem, or a really good team to come and work for, or a really good dynamic to come and work for. So I urge everybody here to not fall into the trap of offering lots of gimmicks. It just doesn't work to hire engineers. It's not the way that you build a growing team. By all means, go and put on free lunch or free coffee, but don't put it as the first line in your job adverts, for God's sake. Okay, so no gimmicks. I'm just going to kind of preach that one, because I've seen the ultimate opposite end, and it's horrible. It's just horrible. Right, this is a bit of audience participation for this slide. How many people here, I hope most of you manage at least one or two engineers. Yeah? What do you think your most important role is? Anybody want to shout out any? Anybody?
Giving them the chance to focus.
That one there. Absolutely awesome. So I like to say the one biggest role you can have as a manager is to attend meetings so that your engineers don't have to. You are the protection between them and an insult and a distraction. So as chief architect at Xero, I used to attend a huge number of meetings. It was horrible. But every meeting that I used to go to, I was going, well, at least I'm here and not one of my productive engineers, because they're actually getting work done. Hopefully you've all seen this graph before. It's kind of like what happens to focus as you get interrupted as an engineer. People imagine that you pick straight up and you're productive within 5 minutes of a meeting. Instead, it happens completely oppositely. And that's all about how engineering is a task for remembering. You have to have so many things in your head to be doing your job. What's the current variable state? How did I get to this code? What user am I? Where did this bug originate? And as soon as you pull them out of that context, make them switch context, whether it's a meeting, whether it's a phone call, whether it's giving them another task to do, they have to drop all of that out of their head and pick up from the beginning all over again. And even if they go back to the original task, they have to pick up all of that information all over again. It's not quite as slow as it was the first time, unless they've been home, and, maybe they've had a few too many beers, and then it's slower. But usually, it's not a very good process. So really, the core thing you want to do is to protect your engineers from distractions, and one of the biggest ones in a growing team is meetings. Because you will have an inundation. Is that a word? I don't know. I just made it up. I keep making up words and thoughts. It's great. Last talk I had, I made up repetible or something. I'm not quite sure. So inundation of meetings. It just happens. Everybody wants a piece of your engineering team. Everybody wants to understand why this decision was made, or why that decision was made, or can we do this for the marketing site? Or, hey, I've got a really good idea for what we should do in this new market in Kazakhstan. Can I have an engineer to see if we can build it? No, is your simple answer for that one. But the other one is that you can go and attend meetings on their behalf. And then, obviously, if there's a real, real need for an engineer, you schedule it in and you work out when they're actually going to be unproductive anyway, and then pull them into a meeting at that time. So those are my main points, but really it does all come down to trust. So if you're not going away and trusting your engineers, and you don't have a culture where your engineers are trusted to do, to come into work and be motivated to do the job that they were employed to do, CompSci is not a very rewarding rewarding discipline unless you really get rewarded by the minutiae of code and the minutiae of releasing software. So if you don't trust that your engineers are being motivated by that, what do you think they're being motivated by? There are lots of other ways that they could go out and have a very successful career that isn't quite so soul-destroying when they go and talk to their friends, you know, about what they do. No, I'm not saying that. I love being an engineer. But it's very, very much this is why you're an engineer. Is you like code. You like deploying software. You like solving those problems. So trust your engineers that's why they're there. So if you don't remember anything else from this talk, go away and trust your engineers. So thanks. That's all I had to share with you. Unless you've got any questions, my name's Owen. I'm on Twitter at Buildmaster, and that's my email address. You're more than welcome to send me any emails if you have any questions, if you want to pick my brains about growing teams or what it's like to be in big teams or small teams. I also have a whole bunch of Herbert stickers, if anybody likes stickers. You're more than welcome to come and get a sticker from me or talk to me about anything, really.